Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. Brooke is here.
I am. You look sharp.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's less me and more the new background. It's moving. So now we don't have to work as hard.
Right.
Because I think the background will mostly carry us.
If
you're
so
listening
too.
To the podcast, you have no idea what we're talking about.
Right,
sorry. Anyway, you probably feel like the people today who don't watch Game of Thrones, and you're really confused about all the social media activity.
Don't be those people.
Yes, and I'm going to try not to keep talking about it because I'm just going to get mad. Anyway, very glad to have you here.
Yeah, I'm
glad
to be here.
Lots to talk about. Just a heads up, stick around for the end of the show, because in our last block, we're going to talk about something serious and something not serious, and all of it has to do with the Georgia and Alabama anti-abortion laws.
Mm-hmm.
So, actress and activist Evan Rachel Wood, she was sort of sarcastically attacking those bills, and Breitbart attacked her in a very unfair way. But then, some of my favorite self-owns of conservative men that are just delicious, so you're going to want to stick around for that. But along the way, so much to get to. We're going to talk about immigration, Joe Biden's previous statements in that area. Cory Booker compares Elizabeth Warren to Donald Trump, so that's going to be fun. HUD has a new policy that is just horrendous to stigmatize or to try to, tear immigrant families apart mm-hmm. in a particular way. We're going to talk about taxation, so many things, but we do have to start off with the big story of the morning, the big economic story. Donald Trump's trade war with China entered a new phase with China announcing new tariffs. Donald Trump announcing new tariffs just a few days ago. So let's go over those two big changes and the consequences, the fallout from that. China is going to institute tariffs on $60 billion in US goods, which is a, you're seeing here a screenshot from, I believe, the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
Wall Street Journal, thank you. So that's a sizable chunk of all of the exports that we send to China. They're going to be instituting higher tariffs, raising it from either 5 and 10% to 15, 20, 25%. So that is significant. And that comes after last week, Trump imposed a 25% tariff on $200 billion of Chinese imports to the US. He also told aides to begin plans to hit more than $300 billion in other Chinese goods. And to give you an idea of the scale, I mean, that's most of them. That's a lot of all of the trade going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put a 25% tariff on these goods, on a wide category of different goods. They hit back with the exact same level tariff. And so, of course, he is complaining, saying it's unfair that they're doing this. And we'll get into some of what he's said about it. But this is a story that we've been tracking for like a year now. And every time they ratchet up, he talks about how awesome it's going to be for the US. And we find out that it's bad overall for our economy. It's particularly bad for certain sectors like farming and things like that. A number of factories have been shut down because the parts that they use are more expensive thanks to these tariffs. It seems almost uniquely designed to hurt Trump supporters in business, but he has not dissuaded yet.
Yeah, and China has the power here because America loves to buy Chinese goods
mm-hmm.
more than it appears they like to make things in America.
Mm-hmm.
And because our country, I mean, we can barely get to the point where we're forcing companies to pay living wages here in America.
Mm-hmm.
But we do turn a blind eye to horrible, almost like human rights abuses when you think the small amount of money that some of these massive companies are able to pay workers in other countries. They're just not making things here. So China, mm-hmm. I think, has the upper hand. They're like, sure, we'll do the exact same thing, but guess what? You need us more than we need you.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, if you look inside of China, there are some reasons to believe that things are getting a little bit better in a way that would make them make the condition for Chinese workers better, but also make the cost comparison between producing the goods in the US and producing them in China a little bit less disparate.
Uh-huh.
Sure. But that is a slow process. That's going to take a while. I want to turn now to Donald Trump, what he has been saying as a result of this back and forth, especially because one of his big economic advisors came out and said, acknowledged that these tariffs are going to hurt people here in the US, something that Donald Trump is not willing to do. It's objectively true, but he's not willing to acknowledge it. And so Donald Trump said this, there is no reason for the US consumer to pay the tariffs, capitalized, which take effect on China today. This has been proven recently when only 4 points were paid by the US, 21 points by China, because China subsidizes product to such a large degree. I have no idea what he's saying there, but what he is intending to do is to cloak with ambiguity a very simple truth. And that truth is that when he raises tariffs on goods coming from China to the US, China doesn't pay for those things, we pay for them.
Right.
If you want to get that product and have it shipped here, you still have to pay for it, except now it's more expensive. That's just how tariffs work. And I can't help but think that we could have avoided a lot of trouble if he just Googled what are tariffs. Because he started talking about them and he started putting them in effect without really seeming to have any idea of how they actually work. So he has a little bit of advice, I guess, because this this tweet storm, while it is still disingenuous, it does imply that he sort of gets that he's somewhat losing that messaging war. He says, the tariffs can be completely avoided if you buy from a non-tariffed country or you buy the product inside the USA, the best idea. That's zero tariffs. Many tariff companies will be leaving China for Vietnam and other such countries in Asia. That's why China wants to make a deal so badly. Okay, so he's not wrong that if you were to buy that exact same good from a non-tariffed country or you were to purchase it from a manufacturer here in the US, you wouldn't have to pay the tariff. There's a reason that you're buying it from China in the first place though, because that's where they're made. That's where they're made, and they're not made in the US. Maybe some of those products are made in Korea or in Vietnam or something like that. If that's the case, you're probably buying it from them anyway. You can't suddenly, like those businesses are not suddenly going to crop up in the US just because you've raised the price on Chinese goods. And by the way, let's say he's not trying to fix things immediately, but he's putting in effect policies that will lead to these industries coming back to the US. They will come back to the US because the cost has now been artificially increased in China. It doesn't suddenly become cheaper to make in the US. Now, maybe it will be a little bit more appealing because that's the only alternative, but the price will still be higher. And so in the end, okay, maybe you've led to some more jobs in the US, but we're still paying artificially inflated prices for those goods. And so from a consumer's point of view, this is a little, I guess, it's another alternative explanation as to why he thinks that this would be good, since he's retreating from his original one. It's still not a good deal from the point of view of American consumers.
Right, something you said at the top of that statement there, just it's not even possible. These tweets do seem like he understands what tariffs are more, but you can't just snap your fingers and say, well, buy American. A lot of these things aren't, there aren't even competitors that manufacture things here. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, what is there one, like even just on basic things, what is there one sneaker company that actually makes the shoes here?
I don't even know.
I think it's New Balance.
Oh, does it do that?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
You want a pair of New Balances?
Yeah. And I don't, from the point of view of an American consumer, whether your goal is lower prices or better work environments for the workers in other countries, I don't know why it would be preferable that these companies would ship, would move from China to Vietnam as an alternative. I don't know why that would be better. I understand that he's sort of single-mindedly trying to stick it to China at this point.
Right.
While simultaneously making the case that he's the one who's actually for a better relationship with China. And look, I understand. China engages in some business practices that are subversive ultimately in many different ways.
That's not the motive here.
No, it's not the motive. Yeah. But yes, if you want to change that behavior, you have to do something. I just think that this is incredibly self-defeating and one of the worst options you could take if your goal was to get China to change, you know, their intellectual property law or whatever it is that you're trying to do, the way that they manipulate currency. Mm-hmm. This does not appear to be the way to do it. And again, as you pointed out, considering the trade imbalance that he understands is there, they do have more power in this relationship. And so he can keep trying to do this. It's only going to hurt us more and more as time goes on. Now, with that said, we are going to take a short break. We come back, Susan Ferris is going to join us for the Center for Public Integrity. Donald Trump has been claiming that immigrants are sort of a net loss for American taxpayers. We're going to uncover the facts behind that statement after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
What is the true economic impact of immigrants in America, both documented and undocumented? If you listen to the Trump administration, you get one idea, but the facts might not actually back that up. And joining us now to break this down, Susan Ferris, senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Very glad to have you here. I enjoyed your write-up recently about this, and one of the things that stood out was there are some economic figures concerning how much in taxes various groups of immigrants pay. And it turns out that the Trump administration was apparently not interested in including those in a recent write-up about this. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So this was about refugees. Refugees and people who are asylum seekers who were granted asylum, which is a big deal these days, right? So we get questions from our audience, from readers. And one of the questions that we get frequently is about costs. And someone wanted to know, when do refugees start contributing as opposed to receiving benefits? And I went back and looked at reports that had come out, and one of them was a report that the Health and Human Services Department did that the Trump administration borrowed from, but only looked at the costs. And this is a common trick in politics to just look at costs of a particular group and not look at contributions. And this Health and Human Services report, it was never released, but it was leaked to the New York Times, which put it on its website. But we went and read it carefully and looked at some other figures. And that report found that over a 10-year period, refugees and people who received asylum actually paid $63 billion more in tax revenues to local, state, and federal governments than they took out in services, including what's probably the biggest, which is K-12 education.
Susan, can you break down just for our viewers the difference between refugee status and someone seeking asylum?
Sure. Refugees are vetted abroad. Those are the people that you may see living in refugee camps or living in you know, cities in Turkey or Syria or places in Southeast Asia. A lot of refugees who've been admitted in recent years are Burmese, some Syrians, of course, and people from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And refugees go through a long vetting process, and then they're given permission to come in, and they're given some help. When they get here, their travel expenses are paid, but they have to pay it back. And they can start working pretty quickly. Asylum seekers are the people who show up at borders, or they're already in the U.S., and they come forward and say, I would like to seek asylum. You know, there's people who have come in on visas. They're working. They're students. They come from a country with persecution. And they may be a targeted group. And those are the people that are asylum seekers. Those people can apply for a permit if they pass their initial credible fear interview to get a work permit. But they have to wait 5 to 6 months usually to get that. And then they wait longer because their petition has to go to immigration court. They're not allowed to have an appointed attorney, but they can have an attorney. And a lot of those people, someone pays for them to have one, like maybe a family member here, or they get a pro bono attorney.
So you talked about some of the figures of sort of the net gain beyond any sort of social spending or social services or anything like that from this community. That I found even to be surprising. I mean, I don't buy into the belief that this is some sort of massive drain or anything like that, but $63 billion over a decade is quite a bit of money. In what form does that come? How is that actually being generated at the different levels that you mentioned?
Well, people are working and they're paying sales tax, they're paying income taxes, might be paying property tax. You know, refugees have a really high rate of participation in the job market, and asylum seekers. Once they get a work permit, they go to work. We did a story last year with, I think it was in 2017 in Idaho, where dairy farms that have labor shortages had Burmese refugees working alongside Mexican immigrants and people from the Congo working at dairy farms. You know, I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and you can see all sorts of people from refugee countries working all the time.
So it's interesting. I mean, of all the arguments that I've heard, either for or against changing the number of asylum seekers or refugees that we're allowing in, I've never seen, it seems like you could make the case that certain states should be competing over these populations because they're effectively investments that pay off over the course of a few years. But I've never actually seen it put that way. Would that be a fair way to characterize why an area might want to allow more refugees from a particular part of the world to come in?
Well, this particular area in Idaho has a long history of admitting refugees. You know, it might seem odd to some people, but Twin Falls, Idaho has a long tradition of organizations there that are religious and some university organizations that pave the way to bring people in. There's people there who now work at assisting at bringing in refugees who were refugees themselves. So when I talked to dairy farmers there, they were very interested in putting refugees to work, especially because people weren't coming over the border anymore from Mexico in the numbers they used to, and construction companies too. It's an interesting thing. And, you know, I don't want to minimize the fact that there are expenses at first. Especially, I think schools have expenditures they have to make if they're going to, you know, invest in helping people, the children learn English. There are people that receive some public assistance, food stamps, some cash. That's primarily refugees who come in vetted, ready to go. But those numbers decline over the years dramatically. Very dramatically.
Well, fascinating data. It would be very interesting to see if more people were aware of this, how it might shift their views on refugee resettlement. Susan Ferris of the Center for Public Integrity, thank you as always.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. We have barely begun to dig through all the old videos of Joe Biden that are being unearthed on a number of different topics. And we've got one now from 2006. He was giving a speech and it had to do with immigration and drugs. And take a look at the way that he talks about this particular issue. It might remind you of politicians in the modern era just a little bit.
I voted for a fence. I voted, unlike most Democrats, some of you won't like it. I voted for 700-mile fence. But let me tell you, we can build a fence 40 stories high unless it changes the dynamic in Mexico. And you will not like this, and punish American employers who knowingly violate the law when in fact they hire illegals. Unless you do those two things, all the rest is window dressing. Now, I know I'm not supposed to say it that bluntly, but they're the facts. They're the facts. And so everything else we do is in between here. Everything else we do is at the margins. The reason why I parenthetically, why I believe the fence is needed is not related to immigration as much as the drugs. I'm the guy that wrote the National Crime Bill. I'm the guy that wrote the National Drug Track. I'm the guy that wrote the law that set up a drug czar. But let me tell you something, folks. People are driving across that border with tons of everything from byproducts from methamphetamine to cocaine to heroin. It's all coming up through corrupt Mexico.
Okay. So that was 2006. It was not the 80s. It was not the 90s. It wasn't that long ago. Now, there's a lot in there. And I believe we were talking during the video. I think that's a Rotary Club that he's talking to.
It looks like it.
Or it's people who are also in a Rotary Club in any event. And so look, he's talking about immigration. He's talking about fencing. He's talking about drugs. And just got to call it like it is, a lot of the ways that he was talking about it do sound a lot like Donald Trump. You don't think that's fair?
I don't think this is fair at all.
I don't think it's 100% like that.
I just don't.
And I will give Biden credit in a couple of ways, but okay, first you say.
It's just not fair. And I have been, I feel like I've learned a lot about this man just by some of these videos that have unearthed and how gross they've been. But if anything, he has been very clear on how awful Donald Trump has been on immigration. He has been very clear. And so without context of and listen, I get it. There are some things that I feel like are unforgivable, but he and Bernie Sanders both voted for a horrible crime bill that horribly, I mean, he drew it, but that, you know, horribly
and
affected
Bernie
black Americans.
Bernie said at the time that he was voting for it because of the protections for women against domestic abuse.
And it still harmed black Americans.
That's true.
Kamala was the crime bill. Elizabeth Warren was, jokes, but like, I think that all of them have made huge mistakes in the past. And my biggest issue with Joe Biden is that there are a lot of mistakes he's made in the past that we're learning about that he hadn't said anything about. Mm-hmm. This is something that before this video even came out, a year ago, you know, we knew where he stood on Dreamers, more than a year ago. You know, uh-huh. We've known where he standed on family separations, where he stood on undocumented servicemen mm-hmm. and women. So it's a little unfair. He's a really, really old man who has changed his mind on
that's fine.
And we can make that decision.
But again, this is not 1994. This is 2006.
Yeah, but it's 2019. It was 13 years ago.
I understand that.
Changed.
Okay, well, at least let me go through some of the concerns that I have. First of all, that he uses the term illegals.
Right.
That's a Republican thing. We don't do that. Okay, it's 2006. I would like to imagine that people would have not called them illegals at that point. Look, people are going to have an issue with the fact that he, like Hillary Clinton, was very supportive of border fencing or whatever. There is a distinction between fencing and a wall. It's not a big distinction. It seems kind of similar. It's cheaper, I guess, but it's the same sort of idea. The idea that people are just driving tons of drugs across the border. I mean, how many videos have we done here at the Damage Report disputing Donald Trump's assertion that that's what's happening? We know the stats from the DEA show that that's not actually the way that drugs are getting across, that you don't need to put, like, you don't need a fence across a gulch to stop people from driving their F-150 mm-hmm. with meth in the back. That's not actually how it works, but he was advancing those same sorts of ideas back then. He has a little bit more nuance. He says that you can't just make a border fence. You also have to target, you know, US employers who are employing these people. I personally don't think that that's a gigantic problem that needs to be fixed, but at least for a Republican to admit that would be a little bit more consistent. So I guess he's doing that to some extent. But none of what he's saying to this group implies an overwhelming concern for the actual people.
Right.
And his policy solutions are not dissimilar from what most Republicans, if not Donald Trump, are in pursuit of right now. Now, it is true, perhaps he has changed his theories on border fencing and security and things like that.
Perhaps.
But it's not like this was the 90s.
I get it, but what do you
this
want?
This was what he
you
believed when he was in power.
But you want, he's always been in power.
No, but I'm saying in the White House specifically.
It was 06. Right? Mm-hmm.
I understand that. That's right before he becomes vice president.
Right, but he wasn't in power in the White House.
Yes.
So we can't say that he was.
But we also can't assume that in 2 years he drastically changed his mind on
immigration. Well, look what they did for Dreamers. You think that he didn't support that? You think he was completely against it?
I'm not saying this guy despises immigrants. I'm saying that we have to use what we have. And what we have is a guy who, when he's in a group of people who look like they belong to a Rotary Club, he's saying that we have to deal with illegals, and I believe that they're driving drugs across the border.
Right, but when he's helping lead the country, he's protecting them. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I feel we have to consider
when
we're
both.
Not fair about major and massive changes and policy changes that mm-hmm. people have made, it minimizes our effectiveness when there's a video and there's information that hasn't been rectified. Mm-hmm. That right there has overwhelmingly been rectified.
Specifically about border fencing and walls and things like that? I will have to see. Yes, we have to consider both the good and the bad. Anybody who sees just this video and says that you should never support him and vote for Donald Trump, obviously that's crazy.
Nobody should say that, period. Right?
But I will also add that just to put another dot in the history of his relationship with that crime bill, he was bragging about having led the charge in 2006.
Listen, and we're
quite
still
a
not
while
past
later.
That. We're still not past that. There's a lot. I mean, but this, I for me at least personally, am past that. He helped lead the country when they made decisions specifically to protect Dreamers, mm-hmm. and he spoke out on his own. Of course, he knew he was going to run for president. We didn't know. We thought, but years ago he spoke out against. A year ago, he spoke out against family separations.
Okay.
So I just don't. This is not fair for me.
I consider that like again ground floor.
It is.
Like if you can't speak out against family
not
separation,
being like this is ground floor for me too. And so the fact that he is not, I don't think he should get extra credit. I just think it's unfair to push down on him because of that. If he's come back to the bare minimum.
We have a lot of candidates, and I'm assuming that most of them in 2006 weren't talking like this.
A lot of them in 2006 were saying all kinds of other wild stuff, though, that they shouldn't have said.
Okay, and we'll continue to go through that. Like, in fact, we have one right now, actually, that we're going to talk to.
Okay.
Well, it's actually more recent than that. Anyway, that's just giving you an idea. It's out there. Again, as Brooke is pointing out, you have to weigh the stuff from these videos with what they're saying now, and we will see if he is a strong advocate for not funding border walls and tearing down what's there, then that would be strong evidence that he's moved on from this position. So we will be on the lookout for that. Okay, moving on. Facebook has been in the news recently with one of the co-founders saying that it is time for it to be broken up. And that has actually become one of the issues that the different Democrats pursuing the presidential nomination have been weighing in on. Cory Booker was asked about this. And in sort of advancing his position in this area, he also weirdly compared Elizabeth Warren to Donald Trump. Take a look.
I don't care if it's Facebook, the pharma industry, even the agricultural industry. We've had a problem in America with corporate consolidation that is having really ill effects. It's driving out the independent family farmer. It's driving up our prescription drug costs. And in the realm of technology, we're seeing small one or two companies controlling a significant amount of the online advertising.
So should they be broken up?
Well, I mean, you know, again, I believe in process. And we should have, if I'm president of the United States, I will have a Justice Department that uses antitrust legislation to do the proper investigations and to hold industries accountable for corporate consolidation.
Elizabeth Warren's already out there saying break up Facebook, break up Google.
But I don't think
break up Amazon.
Right, but I don't think that a president should be running around pointing at companies and saying breaking them up without any kind of process here. Do I think it's a massive problem in America, corporate consolidation? Absolutely. It's about making sure that we have a system that works. It's not me and my own personal opinion about going after folks. That sounds more like a Donald Trump thing to say, like I'm going to break up you guys. No, we need to create systems and processes.
You just compared Elizabeth Warren to Donald Trump.
I most certainly did not.
Well, that's what she's saying. She's the one that's saying that.
Well, again, she has. Let her discuss and debate her positions. I'm telling you right now, we do not need a president that is going to use her own personal beliefs and tell you which companies we should break up. We need a president that's going to enforce antitrust laws in this country, and I will be that person.
Okay, so in a sec, we're going to have a couple of different candidates, what they have said about breaking up Facebook. But first of all, can we just be clear? He says, I certainly did not compare her. Yeah, he did.
He says absolutely nothing, essentially, in that entire statement. First of all, he's asked a yes or no question. Mm-hmm. Should these companies be broken up? And he dodges that, which is weird. And then they point out that Elizabeth Warren has a very direct answer about this. And then he does compare her to Trump and then dodges that, like falls back on that, which is mm-hmm. a little, I don't know, disrespectful to everyone's intellect. And then also is asked, like in furthering his response, I don't think a president should talk like that. Okay, so then do you think they should be broken up? I don't think a president's personal beliefs, this is what this is about. Mm-hmm. Your personal beliefs, no one's saying that you get to go in and your personal, only Donald Trump thinks the presidency works like that. But we do want to know what mm-hmm. your personal beliefs are. We want to know, right, exactly. Like, so your personal beliefs on everything matter. Mm-hmm. The system is set up in a way so that your personal beliefs don't matter. Like you can't just go in and just change everything just mm-hmm. because you personally feel like that. The system is already set up like that. We got that part, bud. Yeah. But what are your personal beliefs? That just was odd.
Yeah, and I also found it to be pretty condescending towards Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
That, like the idea that her thinking that it's time to break up these monopolies is just her personal opinion. She just thought about it. There's been no research, there's no process. He keeps talking about process, she doesn't have process. He has a process, she just has personal opinions.
Right, and as if her history as a politician, as a public servant essentially, doesn't shape her personal opinion. Yeah. Her personal opinions matter.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you'd like to find out more about what she thinks on this, you can go to the very
she's got a policy.
Very blunt. Yeah, she does. She wrote this. Here's how we can break up big tech. And she goes in depth on Medium, and you can see why she thinks that needs to happen. And obviously, if she were to become president, she wouldn't come in day one and then DM them that they're broken up. That's not how it works. The idea that he's the only person that would have some sort of process or no, that's ridiculous. Everybody would, obviously.
You have to.
Exactly. And that process already exists, by the way.
Right.
Monopolies have been broken up. This is not some wild new thing that she's thinking about. It's just the modern version of other problems that we've had with telecoms and oil companies and things like that in the past. She's also, by the way, not the only person talking about this. Kamala Harris said, I think that Facebook has experienced massive growth. It has prioritized its growth over the best interests of its consumers, especially on the issue of privacy. There's no question in my mind that there needs to be serious regulation, and that has not been happening. There needs to be more oversight. That has not been happening. When Jake Tapper asked her directly whether she believed that Facebook should be broken up, she said, yeah, I think we have to seriously take a look at that. Yes, I mean, when you look at the issue, they're essentially a utility, which is not the same thing as saying, let's break them up, but it's closer than Booker. Booker is saying, you know, we're gonna have a process, we're gonna have a thing, check back in 32 years, we'll see what happens. Take a look at his donors, you might have an idea of why he's wanting to sort of run out the clock on that. Mm-hmm. But she's been pretty strong. Bernie Sanders tweeted, I applaud Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes for sounding the alarm on the dangers of unchecked corporate power. We're living in an era of monopolies that dominate every aspect of our lives, including our government. It's time to take that power back. That I would say is actually slightly less in the direction of breaking them up than what Kamala Harris said, and certainly than what Elizabeth Warren said.
Right.
He seems to be okay with the idea, but he's not specifically calling for it yet.
And he's right, they do need more oversight. But I also want to push back on the idea that social media is a utility. We are not going to get to a point, as much as we depend on it and we are obsessed with it, we're not going to compare it to water. And like our need for it. That's absolutely ridiculous. And there is competition. Facebook is.
You don't think we need Twitter?
I want it.
And Twitter's not one of the ones that's being talked about being broken up.
But. Right. But wouldn't Twitter be a direct competition of Facebook, though? Like this idea that there is no competition, it's just not as popular as Facebook. But
yeah, I mean, the argument that they make is that places like Amazon are both a platform for a service to be sold and also a person who's selling things on the service. So Amazon is a place that you could sell things. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest one. They also sell things on there. Google and Facebook are sort of similar in that respect, that they are both a platform and an entity operating in that platform. And obviously, the fact that it's their platform gives them a massive advantage over everyone else. So that I find that argument more compelling than just the generalized idea that it's a utility.
We were talking about this before the show a little bit, and I guess I just have more questions. And it's easy for me to respond to Cory Booker's statement because he didn't really give us one, and I think that there's
fast. That statement from Cory Booker is Cory Booker. He's got some good plans and some stuff. He doesn't seem like a genuinely bad guy. If he were president, there'd be some good days in the news, but the vast majority of it would be sort of like verbal, like doing laps, just. Obviously, he receives money from these industries. He does not want to shake things up too much. It would be another thing like Obama. It'd be like 5% change in a lot of these things. But generally, we wouldn't drastically rethink things like breaking up the biggest corporations in the world or anything like that. That's just who he is. It's not in his, like there are some areas where I don't think that he is receiving much money. So for instance, on marijuana, he's come out with a very good plan. He's willing to legalize it and all that stuff. But in big areas, I just don't think he's going to be that candidate. I think that other candidates, whether they're the most progressive, Warren and Bernie Sanders, or even Kamala Harris in some of these areas, are more likely to be willing to like fundamentally rethink the status quo of some of these industries.
Is it a monopoly if you just happen to be better at it than your competitors that already exist?
I mean, that might be the reason it becomes a monopoly, but it could still be a monopoly regardless.
If there are competitors?
I mean, no monopoly exists without any competition whatsoever. It's the idea that it's so big that there's effectively no competition.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it has to be broken up.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I'm relaying the arguments for why that might be.
No, yeah, and I think I'm.
And I'm generally okay with it if they want to do that.
I'm confused by this a little bit.
Okay, well,
shocked a little bit.
Perhaps Cory Booker's process will.
It made it worse for me.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. And there will be more plans, I'm assuming, since this is a big thing in the news. Now, that said, we do have to take a short break. When we come back, HUD targeting immigrants once again. We'll show you how after this. Let's turn now to the latest way the Trump administration is trying to attack immigrant communities in the US. So HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has a new plan to effectively try to either separate families where some of the families documented and some are not, or at least scare those people into self-separating because of this new policy. So they have a proposal published on Friday of last week that would prohibit families in which at least one member is undocumented from obtaining subsidized housing, a move that was made without the knowledge of many longtime housing officials at the department, which is on its face a great sign of the policy that you have to hide it from people who've been working in that industry for a long time. And if you look more into this, sources speaking with the New York Times say that when those officials did find out about it, they considered it to be an immoral policy, because it is. Now let's give you some more details. Current rules bar undocumented immigrants from receiving federal housing subsidies, but they do allow families of mixed immigration status to live in subsidized housing as long as one household member is a legal resident. Now, HUD analysis of what this policy would lead to said, HUD assumes that most mixed households will leave HUD's assisted housing as a result of this rule. HUD expects that fear of the family being separated would lead to prompt evacuation by most mixed households, whether that fear is justified. That, to me, is a reason not to have the policy, but they're going forward with it because that is the goal, of course. Similar to family separation at the border, actually doing the thing, the policy to an individual family is great from their point of view, but the fear that it would engender in the population at large is far better. That has a more of a deterrent effect. They want to effectively hound these people from the time they come across the border, if that's how they come here, to any way that they're interacting with the federal government in terms of housing and all of that. Regardless of what effect this would have on people who are in perfectly fine legal standing with the US.
Right, they want to even bar undocumented immigrants from signing leases for HUD housing. So like essentially the current rules are if you are an 8-year-old that is a legal US citizen, you are an American citizen, and you are able to get HUD subsidized housing, under the normal rules, you still can get that housing even if you live with someone who's undocumented. Maybe you have a guardian who's undocumented. You live with them. They don't get any portion of the subsidized housing. It's cut up. And if it's like there's four people living there, you only get 1/4 of it for that one legal resident. But now they're saying, nope, nobody can live there.
Exactly.
So then where does the 8-year-old who is an American citizen and who is due
get separated
this money, where do they go? Where do they live? Who takes care of them?
We won't know because no computer system will be set up to track them.
Exactly.
We know that. Okay, now the fun part. Let's play a little game. Who in the White House came up with this policy? That's enough time. It's Stephen Miller. He, along with White House aides, sent the new regulation to HUD officials this year. And I love this detail. Ben Carson, obviously head of HUD, was not pleased with the changes, and he questioned how they would be enforced, but did not object, according to two people familiar with the situation who spoke on the condition of anonymity. So it's a policy that he doesn't like, and he doesn't know how they would actually put into effect. But he's going along with it.
Right, he said okay.
Because he's a Trump crony. That's what he does. And again, his concern is it might not be enforceable, but what's the difference? The whole idea is to scare people into leaving the housing willingly, not to actually track down all of these households and be able to say in any one case exactly who lives there and who might be living there temporarily or who might have lived there at one point. They don't need to actually do that. What they need to do is publicize that they're going to be tracking these people down. That's the goal. And Ben Carson, totally fine with that.
Right. It's completely irrelevant that he didn't like it because he said okay with it.
Exactly.
And it was just,
exactly. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. The new anti-abortion laws in Georgia and Alabama have led to a lot of response from the left, some of it positive, some of it less so. But the response to the response from conservative men has been at times hilarious. So you're not going to want to miss it. Like many people across the country, Evan Rachel Wood, actress and activist, was frustrated with the new bills passed in Alabama and Georgia. One actually passed, one is getting closer to it, that effectively make abortion illegal and would in fact possibly send both doctors and women to jail for a very, very long time if they were to either actually have an abortion or in some cases just plan to travel somewhere outside of the state to get one. And so in her frustration, she tweeted this. Mandatory vasectomies until you want to have children, they can be reversed. So come on, guys, let's save lives. What's that? A hard no? Why? Because it's your body and we don't get to make that choice for you? Oh. And literally every reasonable person in the country reading that gets that she is making a rhetorical point. Right. She is using sarcasm. And honestly, it's not that different than what's happening in those places. And so it seems like a fair enough point, but that's not how the right responded. So Breitbart posted this. Evan Rachel Wood suggests men get mandatory vasectomies in response to Georgia heartbeat law. And they decided to put a photo, I don't even know where that's from, of her wielding an axe. Because I guess she's the one doing the vasectomies, and vasectomies are performed with hand axes. Is that what it
so
is?
So weird.
I think a doctor would be involved and probably rubber gloves.
Right.
So they posted that. Now look, if you go to that article and you go down far enough, they concede that she's not being serious. But if you just look at the headline, if you look at the tweet, if you look at it on Breitbart, it looks like she's going to be swinging an axe at your junk. And is that unfair to say that that's what they want conservative men to think?
Like, yeah, it also like, that's how scary they want you to think vasectomies are too, which is
exactly.
So weird.
It's not like that at all,
fragile.
By the way. They are reversible too. They're not gonna take an
sometimes,
axe to you, you'll be okay.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's generally fine. Yes, 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 they are reversible. Now, look, she responded to people attacking her, I would say unfairly from the right on this, saying, the law is to prevent abortions. We know stricter abortion laws do not prevent them. We have seen that time and time again. So this, her proposal, would literally make abortion impossible. We can't impregnate ourselves. The idea being that if every man did that, you would not have to worry about unplanned pregnancies. So hypothetically, it's a thing that the right could get behind. But she did have to respond to the fact that people were mischaracterizing her statement, saying, I don't want mandatory vasectomies because I don't believe we should legislate people's bodies. It's a dangerous, slippery slope. I use the example to point out the hypocrisy of always putting the responsibility, punishment, blame, or means of prevention solely on women, which is a 100% fair point to make.
Right, and it's like, girl, we know. The normals know.
Yeah, the normals know, but like, she is a person who is on Twitter, and so right. She has to deal with a lot of abnormals.
Yeah.
I would say that Twitter is unrepresentative in that particular way. But anyway, I share your frustration, Evan Rachel Wood, with the abortion bans in Alabama and Georgia, and the fear that it'll become more common. I mean, if it worked in Georgia, you got to think that there's anti-abortion activists all over the country that are going to be trying to push those heartbeat bills. And they have a conservative Supreme Court that might be okay with it.
I like that you called it anti-abortion because it's what it is. It misrepresents it when you say it's pro-life because a lot of these people are also pro-death penalty, which is a little.
Exactly. And hypothetically, it would not be impossible that some of the doctors instituting this might be affected by that. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what their devotion to life is actually like in practice. Okay, let's end with a little bit of fun though. In social media, Alyssa Milano, she proposed a sex strike in response to the abortion bans in Georgia and Alabama. And that's a divisive topic. We're not gonna get totally into it. I'm personally not in favor of it, but I get where she's coming from to some extent. But talking about the sex strike has led to quite a bit of fun online, some of it purposeful, some of it not so much. And conservative men have been owning themselves over this in a way that I find to be a lot of fun. So I wanna give you examples of what I mean. So Michelle Guido, she tweeted, my problem with the sex strike, it feeds the narrative that women only have sex to satisfy men's sexual needs. It ignores women's sexuality. Women like sex too. That is a very common thing that a lot of women have been tweeting, and most guys seem to understand that that's the truth, but not some. With guys like Scott saying, Michelle, please stop before you say something that ruins your credibility. Women may claim to like sex, but you really don't. You tolerate it under limited circumstances and during limited time frames. That's nature's design. Please be honest now. That is a guy who has had a very unsatisfying sex life, and the women who have interacted with him similarly probably have not had very satisfying experiences.
I mean, it sounds rapey. I think it's more than like just like a weird self-own. That is scary.
Well, he's saying
weird,
that they tolerate it. But yeah, it's not that far away from
like
that.
Like we do something to them that they don't like.
How sad to think that that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. That every woman at best will allow something that fundamentally bothers her in a very real way.
Also, what's so funny about like all of these pushing back against her acknowledging that women don't just have sex to do something for men or don't.
Yeah.
But that these men aren't for the sex strike. They just can't not go against something a woman says.
Yeah, now like, you're making like great substantive points, but I want to make fun of one or two more men because we only have another minute left.
Okay.
So Jones Very says, in my experience, 90% of women seem to use sex to get what they want. The sex strike is just more of the same. Prostitutes gonna barter with their bodies. Are there any women who just enjoy sex and don't leverage it to get stuff? DMs are closed, I'm married.
First of all, nobody—
that's a happy marriage, by the way.
Nobody's getting anything out of you, Jones.
Not in that particular case, certainly. And the best one, I get the point you're trying to make, but I have yet to meet a hetero woman who enthusiastically participates in sex. Go to the gym, man. I don't know what to tell you. Anyway, you can have an issue with the idea of a sex strike, but the idea that women are fundamentally lying about wanting to have sex is probably not the way to approach that,
yeah.
I would say. Well, thank you as always.
Yeah, thanks
great
for
to
having
here.
Me.
Let's see, big guests throughout the week. You understand how the show goes, lots to talk about. We're gonna try to get through it together. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.